May it please the court. My name is Matthew Huckabee. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Bruce Watson. Mr. Bruce Watson admittedly filed his pro se Form 40 out of time. Unfortunately, the sentencing court gave him the wrong information about when he was to file his pro se motion. There's actually two provisions in Rule 2915 and in Rule 24.035 that govern the filing of a Form 40. That rule, both of those rules, require that if no direct appeal is taken, that the movement will have 180 days from the date of delivery to the Missouri Department of Corrections to file their Form 40. However, if they do take a direct appeal in a Rule 2915 case, they have 90 days from the date that the mandate is issued from the Court of Appeals. In this case, the sentencing court only told Mr. Watson about the 180-day deadline. Unfortunately for Mr. Watson, he filed an appeal, which meant at the end of his appeal, he had 90 days from the date of the mandate being issued in his direct appeal to file his Form 40. Mr. Watson's position is that nobody advised him of the actual filing deadline for his Form 40. I would point this court to Bergdahl versus State. I did not cite it in my brief. However, it is a case I came across this morning, last night actually. I have to thank a colleague.
Say the name of the case again.
It's Bergdahl, B-E-R-G-D-O-L-L versus State. The citation is 14 Southwest 3rd, 258. It's a 2000 case from the Southern District.
And would you submit a letter to the court after oral argument with that cite and a copy to counsel so we have it in writing, please?
Absolutely, Judge. Thank you. Absolutely will. In that case, the Southern District said unequivocally that movement has, and this is a direct quote, movement has a right to rely on representations made by the trial court. And in Bergdahl, it was a post-conviction case, and in that case, the sentencing court required the defendant who was being sentenced to file or to sign an affidavit acknowledging his post-conviction rights. And in that affidavit, the court made a mistake. The court said if you file a pro se motion, counsel will be appointed. Then Mr. Bergdahl, the defendant in that case, I'm actually not sure if it's a male or a woman, but in any event, they went ahead and they filed a Form 40, but they didn't do so. They did not attach an informal pauperis affidavit. And because they didn't, counsel was not appointed, contrary to the information that was in that acknowledgement form. That case is exactly like this case when it comes
That's
to the timeliness.
That's misinformed rather than uninformed.
I'm sorry, Judge.
That's misinformed rather than uninformed.
Correct. But what I would submit to the court is that because Rule 2907 requires the court to advise a defendant at sentencing of their post-conviction rights, I don't believe there is a difference between misinforming and failing to inform. The court is under an obligation to tell the movement or to tell a criminal defendant what their rights are. And in this case, Mr. Watson was prejudiced by that because of the unique circumstances that caused him not to be delivered to the Missouri Department of Corrections.
Exactly. What did the trial court say to him?
The sentencing court in this case told Mr. Watson that he had 180 days from the date that he was delivered to the Missouri Department of Corrections to this day.
So isn't that misinformation?
I would say it's misinformation. I would characterize it as misinformation instead of.
He said you have 180. He said you may have 180. You may have less depending on.
Correct.
Whatever he said.
Absolutely.
Despite the misinformation, doesn't the defendant have an obligation to do all they reasonably can do to ensure that his motion could be or would be timely filed?
Correct. The real question is that Mr. Watson's case is uncharted waters. What happens when a movement is misadvised as to when he is to file his Form 40?
But if they have that duty to take some steps to do all they reasonably can do, what's the record reflect what he did in this case?
He filed a Form 40. He filed the Form 40. It was late, significantly late. I'm not 100% sure. It was at least months late. It may have been years late.
Does the file indicate whether or not the court handed him a copy of the rules that had that?
I'm sorry, Judge, I didn't hear you.
Does the record or the file indicate whether or not the court handed him a copy of the rule that had all of the time
No, Judge. As the record is not clear on whether or not Mr. Watson ever received anything in writing indicating what the rule says as far as when the filing deadline would be. There is a conversation, as in almost every case, about when his basically, it was the 2907 inquiry that happens in nearly, well, and happens in every case where there is a sentence.
And most sentencing courts just hand them that to read along at the same time?
Correct. And as far as I know, there's nothing in the record that would suggest that that was done in this case. But going back to, Judge Russell, your point, really, there is no indication as to what was reasonable for Mr. Watson to do under the circumstance. On the one hand, you have the judge who sentenced you telling you, you have 180 days from the date that you're delivered to the Department of Corrections. And on the other hand, you have the fact that he was never delivered to the Department of Corrections in this case. You couple that with the fact that now a jailhouse lawyer is telling him, you're out of time. When a jailhouse lawyer tells you, you're out of time, and your sentencing judge told you, no, you still got time. You got 180 days from the date that you're sent to the Missouri Department, from the day that you're sent to the Missouri Department of Corrections. What is reasonable for Mr. Watson to do?
Is he put on notice that there's some question that he ought to, that he has an obligation when he's put on notice that he may not have the right information to find out what's correct, as opposed to just do nothing?
I believe that when Mr. Watson was put on notice, he did begin to work on his Form 40, and he began to...
But how long was it between when...
That I'm not sure.
Wasn't it a couple months?
It was a couple months, yes. But the question is, what delay is reasonable? Mr. Watson requested a hearing on the timeliness issue, and the hearing was not held. So there are no facts that I can point to say, well, this is what made it reasonable, this is what made it unreasonable. For instance, I could say that the St. Louis City Justice Center, where Mr. Watson was up until the point that he was taken to the Department of Mental Health, I could say they don't have Form 40s because they're not a prison and they don't usually give out Form 40s. But we don't know that. There was no record made. I could say that the Department of Mental Health doesn't have Form 40s, or they're not readily available, or I can't sit here and tell you about what the law library is like at the St. Louis City Justice Center. I'm not sure if it is a pillar of the law library community. However, there's no record on that. That was something that was not done. The court instead, out of an abundance of caution, admitted that it did in fact make a mistake as to its advice, and out of an abundance of caution, went ahead and ruled on the merits.
So are you saying that this is third-party interference? And if you are, wouldn't that be extending where this court has gone before on defining what third-party interference is?
Correct. It's my position that this case could be decided with the third-party interference exception, and no new exception would be required. However, the timeliness issue brings up an important issue of, as Missouri's president said, who does the buck stop with? If a court is under an obligation to advise somebody of their rights and does so incompletely, what happens? Like, where does that responsibility lie? And what I would suggest is that at the core of this issue is due process. And at the core of due process is notice and opportunity to be heard. Mr. Watson was deprived of both. He was not notified as to the appropriate deadline. Most importantly, as an aside on that, the trial court or the sentencing court knew that Mr. Watson was going to appeal. That was a discussion that was had at sentencing. Is there going to be an appeal? And the trial attorney said, yes, there will be. I forgot my other point.
You're asking for an extension of how we've defined third-party interference.
Correct. Or a good faith exception in a limited circumstance where a movement is misadvised by a court as to the filing deadline under their circumstances. In all likelihood, what would have if Mr. Watson was like any other person who had been sentenced to a Department of Corrections sentence, you would have a situation where he would have gone down probably a week or two after his case was over, and he would have filed a Form 40. And he would have had what we call a premature post-conviction case. And we would ask that it be held because we'd tell him, hey, you can file a direct appeal, and he would. And we would ask that the post-conviction remedy be stayed until the direct appeal was over, because he would have post-conviction rights vis-a-vis his direct appeal attorney. In this case, Mr. Watson was never delivered to the Missouri Department of Corrections. Instead, he was found to be incompetent in another case that's still pending in the city of St. Louis, and he was sent to the Missouri Department of Mental Health. And again, because Mr. Watson was found to be incompetent by another court in the city of St. Louis, albeit after this trial had been done and Mr. Watson had already been sentenced, it does raise some serious questions as to whether he is capable of understanding what the court told him, or if he was capable at the time he was supposed to do something, whatever it was he was supposed to do when he found out he was out of time.
Had he been found incompetent at the time that the jailhouse lawyer told him about
that? That I don't know. The problem is that Mr. Watson, I don't believe, is clear on when exactly that happened. But what he does know is it happened in the city justice center. I think the allegation was that a jailhouse lawyer and of course I keep saying a jailhouse lawyer, but what I'm really saying is another inmate told him, "You're out of time." So
how long after that trial was he found to be incompetent?
I'm not 100% sure. I do know that the competency issue is, as of today, still being litigated. I believe that what I can tell the court is he's in the city of St. Louis, and I believe they're still litigating the issue. So he was found to be incompetent after his appeal was complete. That's what I can tell the court, is that his incompetency determination was made after the mandate issued in his direct appeal, but sometime before I got involved in the case. So it would have been sometime before I was appointed and sometime after the mandate.
Thank you.
Yes. Judge, there's also an issue involving lesser included instructions. It's our position that lesser included instruction should have been given, especially robbery in the second degree. It was consistent with trial counsel's strategy at court, and there should have been a hearing on the issue. Thank you.
We'll hear from you again on rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court. The court has recognized essentially one exception to the mandatory time limit of the filing of an initial pro se motion, which is third party interference. The facts of this case don't fall within third party interference as it was outlined and described by the court in Price. If the court were to apply third party interference in this case, it would need to be an extension or change of that doctrine.
So what happens when a judge misinforms you? What is that?
I think that what happens is, you know that you have a right to proceed under the rule, and you look up the rule and you file your motion.
But if the attorney misinforms you, that
does not constitute third party interference.
If they affirmatively misinform you as to the rule?
That's right. In Price,
we have a case saying that.
I think so. In Price, the defendant retained counsel and told him he would file the motion, and didn't. And the court in Price found that that was not third-party interference, and distinguished it from McFadden, which it labeled as third-party interference after the fact. McFadden had been decided as an abandonment case earlier.
Where the court found that the movement had done everything they could and had gone forward under the rule, and at that point there was third-party interference.
That's right. In McFadden, the defendant had drafted the motion, otherwise within the time limits, and was prepared to file it, but was contacted shortly before filing by an attorney who stepped in and said, "No, instead, give me your motion, and I'll file it." And the court pointed out in Price that the defendant in McFadden had done everything he could reasonably do to file timely, but that by delivering that motion up to a third party who said they would act as courier, was then prevented from timely filing a motion that otherwise would have been timely filed. It was a couple of weeks before the deadline that the third party took the motion.
So why do we require that 2907 hearing and that you be told about your post-conviction rights if the court can misinform you with no consequence?
Well, I think that
isn't that really to the detriment of the client then, who would the defendant would normally rely on what the court said as being accurate?
I think that the court has an affirmative obligation under Rule 2907 to advise the defendant of the right to proceed under the rule. That's what the rule says. Now, there's at least one case that I came across, it's cited in our brief, that says that, in the state's brief, that if the court fails to advise of that, it doesn't excuse the time limits. The court also went on to say in that case that if the court doesn't advise about the 90-day time limit or 180-day time limit, then that also doesn't excuse.
What about the Bergdahl case?
The Bergdahl case, I think, is a little bit different. I haven't read it, but based on the representations that were made today, it appears that in that case, the defendant was told counsel will be appointed to you, and that counsel that later wasn't appointed because apparently an affidavit of indigency hadn't been supplied. Now, the difference, I think, there, an important difference, is that under Rule 2915 or 24035, the rule expressly grants a limited right to counsel for indigent defendants. There isn't a similar right under Rule 2907 to be advised about the time limits under the rule. You're advised of your right to proceed under the rule, at which point you should look at the rule, determine what your right to proceed under the rule is, and abide by those rules. Now, this court has said, in cases like Bullard and Price, Price relying on Bullard, that a movement doesn't require and doesn't need and isn't entitled to assistance of counsel, legal assistance, to file the initial motion. And I think that's because the threshold for filing and invoking your right under the rule has been reduced to the very basement of filing.
What if the client's illiterate?
Well, I think there may be cases where somebody, in fact, I think I cited one in my brief where the defendant couldn't find somebody to help him file his motion within time, and the court said that doesn't excuse it. Now, and that's because the rule doesn't make any allowance for excusable neglect or good cause or anything like that. Now, I understand that this can lead to, for a person in unfortunate circumstances, this can deprive them of an opportunity to proceed under the rule. A person who files on the 91st day is similarly deprived, even though they were just one day. Even if they filed it 1 hour out of time, they would similarly be deprived. You know, for instance, if they weren't good counters and they were looking on the calendar and trying to count it up, if they miscounted and filed it on the 91st day, they'd still be out of luck. It's unfortunate, but we have the rule. When I say that, I guess what I'm suggesting is that there's a line. The court has put the line in the rule. And if we create an exception to that rule, then it means that in some circumstances, well, you can file outside of that. Well, what are those circumstances? And if the court is going to craft another exception or expand the third party exception, I think the court needs to be very clear about how far that goes. Because in this case, suppose you do get misadvice. Is that a license to wait 3 years? Is it a license to wait 5 years? Or does it only give you 1 year?
Well, and why wouldn't the good faith or good cause exception apply under these facts? And why couldn't the defendant rely upon what the judge told him?
Your Honor, I think that if the court wants to adopt a good cause exception, that's certainly within the court's prerogative. It's the court's rule. Good cause, I think, is a fairly amorphous concept. And as soon as the words good cause are employed, I think the next question becomes, well, where's the next line? And again, it leaves open the question of, if you do get misadvice, how long do you get to rely on that advice? Because in this case, he relied on it for, I think, nearly 14 months.
Well, it's because the court told him not until you're delivered to the Department of Corrections, and maybe the defendant is like a lot of lawyers and puts things off to the last minute.
It's possible that he thought that, and he was told, you have 180 days from the time you're delivered to Department of Corrections. He was not told, for instance, that he couldn't file tomorrow or that he couldn't file in a month.
But why would you? I mean, if you're told, you're saying he should have known he didn't really have the time the court said. Why is it in bad faith or not reasonable to assume? I mean, most of the time you are going to be sent to the Department of Corrections.
It's unreasonable. I'm not saying it's bad faith. I'm saying that the rule doesn't make allowances for good faith. It never has. Our cases have been consistent and said that these are mandatory, and it doesn't make allowances for excusable neglect. It doesn't make allowances for good cause. If the court is going to make an allowance for good cause and announce an exception, I think that's the court's prerogative, but I think that the court should be cautious in doing so.
Do we know how long after the mandate issued in his appeal he was found to be incompetent?
That is not revealed by the pleadings.
Would that be relevant if he were incompetent at the time he was supposed to file?
Well, I'm not sure that the rule makes an exception for that either.
Can you address what, as a policy matter?
As a policy matter, I would think, you know, there might be a rule that could be invoked, maybe some sort of equitable tolling for a deadline if somebody's incompetent and can't assert their rights under that rule. But there are other provisions in place that could come into play. You know, for instance, if you don't file by that deadline, you waive your right to proceed under the rule. That doesn't mean that you are forever foreclosed from raising claims that might come later down the road. If you were incompetent, for instance, at the time that you needed to file, you might be able to file subsequently a state habeas petition or a federal habeas petition, and if you can allege facts showing cause and prejudice, then you would be able to overcome the procedural default that comes through the application of our rule. A uniform application of our rule is important for various reasons, both because it can have effects in habeas, but also because our rule was put into place when 2726 was found to be unworkable, where we found ourselves addressing and litigating claims years after the fact. So the time limits of 24035 and 2915 were imposed expressly to avoid that circumstance and that outcome.
The movement, Mr. Watson, he's the proponent of asking us to make an exception to the mandatory time deadlines. And lots of questions have come up as to what has happened, whether he was declared incompetent and when, what happened with the jailhouse lawyer and when. Is it a reasonable requirement for us to, or are we reasonable in denying his claim because he would have the burden of convincing us that these circumstances compel an additional time period, and we're left with many questions as to what the facts are, and that he has not provided information to us?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe it would be reasonable under the facts of this case due to the pleadings, and I think that the burden would be to invoke any exception would be upon the movement to plead all necessary facts and then subsequently prove them at a hearing.
Should there be a hearing at which those can be determined?
Have they been pleaded in the first instance? I would say yes, there should be a hearing, assuming the court is going to announce a new exception to the rule. At the time that this case came before the motion court, the only exception that was out there was a third-party interference exception.
And Price was handed down before the motion was filed in this case.
Your Honor, I'm not 100% sure of that.
And assuming not, then you would hold him to the pleadings requirements of McFadden?
I would still hold him to the pleading requirements to at least plead facts that would say, for instance, bring him within McFadden, which had been established even before Price, although it had been labeled abandonment. I would expect him to plead similar facts under that exception. And so, you know, the motion court confronting this in the first instance, and I think that the motion court, out of abundance of caution and looking at cases like McFadden, probably thought, okay, we have a problem here because somebody did something that interfered or diverted or something with the defendant's decision whether to file the motion. But there are still, I think, deficiencies in the factual pleadings here. It's not apparent when he learned, for instance, that he was out of time. There's an allegation that he was told by another inmate. There's a period of time in the motion that
Was there an attempt at the hearing on the merits to elicit any of that kind of testimony?
I do not think so. I think that the court relied on the single fact that it had misadvised the defendant about the time limit, because the advice it gave the defendant was only half of the advice that might be good practice. And if you're going to elect to tell them about time limits, it's probably good practice to tell them all the time limits, because
would the trial court have complied with the rule if the trial court just said, you're hereby advised of your right to proceed under Rule 2915?
I believe that would have complied with 2907, yes, which requires the court to advise them that he has a right to proceed under the rule.
What happens if the court does not advise him as required?
Well, there's at least one. I think the court's in violation of Rule 2907. Yeah. The effect of that violation is a separate issue. And there's at least one case, which I cited in the state's brief, that says even if that, if the court's in violation of 2907, that doesn't stop the time limits. The time limits are still there, which I guess is proceeds on the notion that you have to invoke your right, and if you don't, that's your misfortune. And as I say, unfortunate circumstances can lead to a result that may seem harsh. But the reason why the court has a line in its rule is so that we can avoid delay, encourage efficient processing of claims, avoid litigation of stale claims, and avoid the situation that arose under 2726. We have lines for that reason. And
did you want to address the merits in the remaining?
Certainly, Your Honor. I'd be happy to address the merits. The motion court, out of abundance of caution, allowed the untimely filing and proceeded to address the merits. The claim in this case is that counsel was ineffective for failing to request. There were three included offense instructions that were alleged in the motion: robbery in the second degree, and then two types of felony stealing were set forth. One, stealing $500 or more, or between $500 and $25,000, and stealing from a person. To be ineffective under those circumstances, first of all, it needs to be an included offense. And the stealing offenses, to the extent that they had elements that were not included within robbery, were not included offenses. They're not designated by statute as lesser degree offenses. They're not attempts. But the robbery in the second degree was plainly an included offense. And so the question is whether counsel had a strategic reason. Now, the motion in this case alleged merely that there was, in a general, I think, conclusory fashion, there's no reasonable strategy. But the motion did not allege, for instance, that counsel inadvertently failed to request it, or that counsel misunderstood the law and failed to request it based on some misunderstanding of the law, which makes it stand in contrast to the McNeil case. The earlier McNeil case decided by this case, where it was alleged that counsel's oversight was due to inadvertence. So here there wasn't any allegation that it was due to inadvertence. And I think that the record refutes the notion that there was no reasonable trial strategy. The trial strategy employed by counsel was plainly an all-or-nothing strategy based on the state's failing to prove an essential element of the offense. And for the other reasons set forth in my brief, I see that I'm out of time. I would also point out that he failed to allege facts showing prejudice. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court.
Just so you know, counsel, in your appellant's brief, you state that on about August 4th, Honorable Mark Neal issued a commitment order finding Mr. Watson incompetent to stand trial.
That's correct. That was a fact I don't currently, I just didn't remember. But yes, there were allegations in the amended motion regarding what we anticipated would be or what the evidence would be at a hearing on the timeliness issue. And I would urge the court to look at the amended motion and probably also my brief. I will also say that in the amended motion, we did allege inadvertence. We did allege that the trial attorney was ineffective and that the ineffectiveness was either due to inadvertence or inattention. That's boilerplate. I'm quite certain that it was in our amended motion. It's cut and paste in almost every amended motion that's filed with any court by my office, for sure. Going back to the timeliness issue very quickly, the American Bar Association's standards on post-conviction remedies says that any deadline for pro se motion is unsound. Here, the state is taking the position that the deadline has to be followed, come hell or high water. It has to be. It doesn't matter if you're incompetent. It doesn't matter if you were misadvised. It doesn't matter what happened. You're responsible. So again, it goes back to our president's first, what he's most known for. Who does the buck stop with? If a court is obligated, again, Price says that counsel, trial counsel, appellate counsel is not under any obligation to advise a movement of his post-conviction rights. But a court is under Rule 29.07.
Does 2907 require the court to advise the defendant of the time limitations?
Yes.
Or just the right to seek relief?
I believe that the way I would respond to you, Judge, would be that it would be a poor right if it was simply you have a right to proceed. What I would suggest is that it would not do a movement any good to tell him that. In fact, I think it would. And interestingly enough, I think that the state's position comes from a point of judicial efficiency, preventing stale post-conviction claims from being litigated. But the state's that position would actually cause premature motions. If I were in Mr. Watson's position and someone told me that, as soon as I got down to the Department of Corrections, which, by the way, Mr. Watson never made it to, I would file a Form 40 as soon as possible. And I'd be premature because I'd have the right to have a direct appeal, and my direct appeal attorney would tell me, you're early on the post-conviction attorney would say,
I understand.
You're out of, you need to do a direct appeal. As far as the merits are concerned,
let's follow that logic, though. Once the appeal, a defendant who has no concept of procedure would still know that the appeal is now over. And if he or she feels aggrieved for any of the reasons listed in 2915, that's the way to go. Why then would you wait? You know, the limitation is on how long you can wait, but why would you wait at all once you know your appeal is over?
I have some clients who file 200-page pro se motions because they feel that they have been greatly wronged. When I am out of time, which happens from time to time, I don't file an amended motion on time. Sometimes it's because I'm trying to get every claim that person has in the amended motion. And without a hearing, I can't tell you why Mr. Watson didn't file on time or right when he found out he was out of time. But I do think it is fair and it is reasonable to allow somebody enough time to put all the claims that they know in their motion.
Did he allege that he didn't have enough time?
There were allegations on the timeliness in the pro se motion. However, I think the allegations were more I didn't know. So, and the court misadvised me. I am a minute and 25 minutes over time. I will be happy to answer any questions the court has, but otherwise, I'll stand on my briefs on the merit issue.
Thank you.
Any cases on timeliness that deal with a defendant who is incompetent and determined to be incompetent?
There are federal cases and there are state of Missouri cases that do, I will concede, that being incompetent, you have no right to competency in PCR.
It does appear that the competency hearing was held 6 months after his motion otherwise would have been due if we don't find the court
correct
statement gave him additional.
But what I will say about that is it does go to what is reasonable for a movement to do. And in this circumstance, what is a movement required to do? Well, if we're looking at the circumstances of Mr. Watson, one of the things we do have to take into consideration is his ability to his ability to read the law, understand it, comprehend it, and act on it. And his competency would be relevant in that conversation. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Case is submitted.